Hello and welcome to Tools in the Shed, a podcast powered by Cars Guide, ready to rip into car stuff that has caught our eye this week. I'm Cars Guide Deputy Editor James, and with me are Editor Mal.
G'day.
And News Editor Tung.
Hello.
Welcome, guys. This week, we're looking at the rise and rise of Hyundai and what it might take to topple Mazda and Toyota in the Aussie new car market. You know, nothing like a bit of virtual product planning, and that's what we intend to undertake during the course of this podcast. We'll discuss a trio of recent entries to the Cars Guide garage, and it's time to farewell the dear leader. Over the years, we've followed Elon's juvenile, entitled, and consistently reckless behaviour. But as the 200th episode of the podcast ranges into view, it feels like we all know him a bit too well. So he's a goner. We've got some upgrades in the works aimed at making the show even more enjoyable, with news on that to come later in the podcast and a little further in the near future. For now, YouTubers, you can jump ahead courtesy of the time codes in the notes below, and you can click on the chapter markers in the timeline. So let's go. And it's a story from this past week, authored by our own Stephen Otley, and it's looking at Hyundai, and of course Hyundai over the last, well, couple of decades, but the last 10 years particularly, has become even more of a powerhouse in this market. And he's theorized, or he's put his product planning hat on and had a look at what they might need to plug some of the gaps in their lineup to match the likes of the top two. You know, Toyota month to month tends to sell roughly double Mazda's number, yet they're one and two. And Hyundai, to come from behind on those two, he's put it out there. So, guys, we were just going to talk about I think it's five different things that Stephen's called out. And the big elephant in the Hyundai room, straight off the bat, is, of course, a one-ton ute. And we're talking about Kia a lot in that context, but they're siblings under the Hyundai group umbrella. Mal, it seems like a no-brainer. It's a yawning chasm in their lineup at the moment.
Absolute no-brainer. And, like, it's my understanding is around the corner, although I noticed we ran a story this week saying it might be under doubt. I didn't actually read that story. Is it still going ahead, do we think?
It is. I think it's just been pushed back. It's been delayed. I think.
Okay. Yeah, we're about to see a lot of that.
Hyundai Australia's made, like, no secret about the fact that it wants a dual cab ute. It needs a dual cab ute to really, you know, put itself up against Mazda and Toyota in this market. You know, the number one seller in this country is Toyota Hilux. Number two is Ford Ranger, you know. I don't think they can sort of leapfrog Mazda and really sort of make a play for the number one spot without something like, you know, a competitive one-ton dual cab ute.
Yep.
Yeah. And the other thing is that that's kind of where the enthusiast market is now.
Yeah, it is.
Aspiring to own utes. So the opportunity to cast a halo over the Hyundai brand as a whole is pretty huge when they bring the ute here.
Yeah, I mean they've got the critical mass as a manufacturer now to be able to just move on things like this. They've certainly got the depth of pockets to have the budget to develop these things. So yes, it's got to be well down the line in terms of its development. But it's been talked about for some time, and the delay may be any number of things. I suppose to every car manufacturer seems to be making this super semiconductor and microchip kind of problem. They wish that'd go away, but who knows?
Yeah, I mean, not to mention last year's, you know, pandemic has kind of forced people to work from home and slowed projects down as well. You know, they want that car sooner rather than later, but you know, I'm sure when it arrives, it's going to be, you know, pretty compelling.
Do we know where they plan to produce it?
No,
not yet. Okay.
That'll
be a big thing as well.
But, I mean, Stephen makes the valid point that with that one model, if they could sell between 10 and 20,000, that would close up the gap to Mazda with just one model. So I'm sure they're ready. And
before we move on, sorry, James. I was just going to say something that really excites me about the upcoming Hyundai ute is what we've seen with the Staria so far. In that the Staria will collectively replace the iLoad and iMax.
So, yes.
You know, commercial van and passenger van.
Yes.
But like the bold design, and you know, that carries right through that car. And we get to sort of touch and feel it in the flesh, but
yes, it's a tribute. It's a tribute, really, to Peter Schreyer, isn't it? Yet again, you know, yeah. Here's the guy who started out with Kia, but as I understand it, he has accountability right across the brands now. Mm. And Hyundai has taken great leaps. And I was going to mention that the first time I went to Hyundai in Korea was in 1988, and we visited the Ulsan plant there, where the headquarters is, on the east, on the coast. And I remember thinking it was kind of medieval, that it was a scary place. It was quite, well, it was loud and not exactly the model of cleanliness. It was a really industrial, almost industrial revolution kind of scene. Mm-hmm. And the cars that were being produced then, a lot of them were the Pony for the US and other models. And I remember going back in 1995, everything was quiet. Robots were in there. It was clinically clean. The quality of the cars being produced was demonstrably better. And I went there again, I think it was 2012 or 2013, and yet again, there was another kind of quantum leap in terms of, well, they were really at the leading edge in terms of how these cars were screwed together. Mm-hmm. So the whole design thing has been in lockstep with that the cars have become more desirable from the way they look and feel, and also the way they're put together is amazing these days.
I might just put up a counterpoint to that design thing. I'm glad you mentioned Stario, Mel. You know, look at things like Tucson, even Palisade, Kona, i30 sedan, Sonata.
This doesn't sound like a counterpoint.
I would say those models are very out there in terms of their styling. You know, so it almost seems like they've taken this direction or this decision to kind of go, you know what, we are going to be very style focused. Our cars are going to look very out there, very polarizing. And if you like it, you come along with us on this ride. And if not, you guys can go elsewhere.
Right. That's a risk, yeah?
Yeah. And look, I don't expect the Ute to look like, you know, a spaceship like the Staria, but I don't think we can expect, you know, I can't imagine what the Ute will look like based on the surprise that the Staria has been.
Yes,
which is exciting. You know, we do renderings, you know, based on Palisades and Tucson's and
all. Yeah, well, your renderings aren't very good, Mal. I know that. I know you tend to do the pure profile style primary school. You know,
if you let me borrow your Derwents instead of being stuck with my Crayolas,
I tend to use Texter. Texter,
righto.
That's the way.
They have iPads for this stuff now, guys. Come on.
Yeah,
of course. But James's textures smell like strawberries and lemons.
They do.
Oranges.
They're very, a lot of them pastel. But the other thing, I suppose, what a one-ton Ute, let's call it that. Stephen makes the point that would lead into a serious off-road style SUV. So, you know, there you've got Toyota with everything from Kluger. They've got the direct connection with Fortuna, Kluger, then up to the Land Cruiser, soon to be 300 series. So if Hyundai could get into that place as well, courtesy of this one-ton Ute, that would be another big step up.
It makes sense to me to sort of to develop the light commercial Ute Staria, their Fortuna Everest equivalent, and a bigger again Land Cruiser, sort of together with, you know, shared elements.
Yeah.
Fingers crossed that's what's happened.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, exactly. And you know, the Palisade is there, and that's more your kind of street-friendly, urban,
passenger-focused
kind of SUV, but one that has that more heavy-duty towing capacity and is able to go off-road and facilitate that more hardcore stuff, that would be a real win.
Yeah, Hyundai's been there before with the Terracan back in the day.
Yeah.
That was Hyundai of another time, and I believe that Terracan was actually more of a second-gen Mitsubishi Pajero under the skin.
Right.
So it kind of dates back to when Hyundai was relying on Mitsubishi for a lot
They were. And I mentioned the Pony. That was largely a Mitsubishi kind of extension anyway, the engine certainly was.
Yeah.
So there's an historical connection there. That's interesting. I didn't realise that. All right. Well, that's good. Terracan. So the other...
Bring back the Terracan.
Terracan. All right. Well, we'll start that campaign. Hashtag bring back the Terracan. And
stickers.
The other thing is we've touched on this car a lot. It's in fact, our touching has probably been inappropriate. We've done it so much. The Santa Cruz, which is the light lifestyle, you not meant as a hard worker, but more as a facilitator of fun and lifestyle activities. We've had disagreement in the podcast, but what do you guys think in terms of its potential for success in this market?
Huge. I think huge potential.
Huge potential.
Right. Huge potential. I mean, you look at the lifestyle ute market, that $60,000 plus, right?
Yeah.
People are buying utes because they think they might use the tray, or they kind of drive down a gravel path to the beach on the weekend.
Yeah, from the garage to the road.
Yeah, you know, yeah. So no one, or I would argue, and I would wager that the vast majority of people buying those utes don't need the full capability of a one-ton dual cab ladder frame chassis ute. Why not get one that's based on an SUV that rides better, that, you know, is got a petrol engine? And is
comfortable. Don't you love it? I've probably mentioned this before, sorry, but don't you love it when you're in a traffic jam and you're on a dual carriageway and the first person to kind of just go, I'm out of this, and mount the median strip is always someone in a four-wheel drive ute. And you can just feel them thinking, yeah, right, this justifies my purchase entirely. This is exactly when you need the four-wheel drive.
$5,000 lift kit.
Yeah, it's so worth it. Yeah, exactly.
I've got a counterpoint for you, Tom.
Go for it. Go for it, Mel.
That sounds really pragmatic and sensible, your attitude. But I think Australian ute buyers tend to still want to know they have the capability in their back pocket, even if they never use it.
For the traffic jams. That's right.
For the traffic jams. Think of the Prados that get sold that never, ever see dirt. And they're immensely capable cars.
Yeah.
And not cheap. Right. Either. I think Santa Cruz would be a big risk bringing it here, but it's a shame we're not going to see what potential it might have.
Like, right, right. I'd, so you I'd think it's neither see. Fish nor fowl. Like it's not a hard worker. It's not a real featherweight. It's somewhere in between. It doesn't have what people would want in this market.
I don't know. I'm not sure, but it's a shame we're not going to find out.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that sort of thing, right? Because like the Veloster was a little bit like that, wasn't it? Wasn't quite a hatchback, wasn't quite a coupe, and it's not here anymore.
But I mean, initially it was such a big success. People fell in love with it pretty quickly when it arrived. But that honeymoon kind of cooled over a period of a few years, I suppose.
It didn't do anything particularly well, I think. It wasn't particularly cheap. It wasn't particularly, I mean, it looked unique, but I don't think it was massively appealing to look at.
Sure.
I wonder if an 86 would also fall into that category.
You know? Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, it's basically, the front of it is basically Tucson.
Yeah,
there you go.
I mean, it's based on that. So Tucson will tell the tale on whether or not people are in love with the way it looks.
Tucson will tell the tale. Nice alliteration there.
Yeah, it could be a that'd be a good first sentence for a novel.
And a big Tucson T at the start.
Tucson will tell the tale. I'd read that book. Anyway, I mean, another one, we were speaking of Tucson. And we've been all over that vehicle, the new one, not long in this market. And we've been bemoaning the fact that the engine is maybe not its strongest point, and specifically in the sense that it's not offering hybrid, plug-in hybrid, any other alternate powertrains. And the one of the excuses allegedly is that it's built in Czech Republic. But I couldn't help thinking, Mel, that you'd been to that plant and followed an Australian-built car and participated in its construction. Am I wrong or right?
Oh, yeah, we built one from the ground up.
Right, so that was an Aussie. That car was going to come to Australia, and it did. And then we drove it from Melbourne up to Sydney, I think.
Put it to the Richard test.
Yeah, we did. Yeah, we did. That seems like a bit of a thin excuse.
I think it's based on the cost of getting it here from the Czech Republic.
All right. But, I mean, that business case added up in the past. Maybe there's a currency differential or something now that means it doesn't, yeah?
Yeah. And look, you know, all of our thoughts on the Tucson are based on only having driven the 2-litre to date.
Yep.
But even as the the cheaper of the two engine options, it's, you know, it's going to get a 1.6 liter turbo petrol shortly. It's pretty expensive.
Right.
So it's expensive, but with a low tech 2 liter. I mean, it does the job, but there's, mm-hmm. as an all new car, you know, it doesn't come with an all new engine with sort of doing anything particularly well under the skin.
Sure.
So it's a bit of a shame.
Like I haven't driven the new Tucson yet, so I can't really speak on how, you know, that engine is in the new car. But, you know, you look at last year's sales figures, the number one SUV sold in the country was Toyota RAV4, right? Mm. And there was such a high percentage of RAV4 hybrid customers that if Toyota RAV4 hybrid was its own, like, nameplate, it would still be the number one best-selling SUV in Australia.
Yeah, right. Yes,
so that's there's clearly an appetite, you know, for hybrid or electrification in the mid-size SUV space. And there is a Tucson hybrid available overseas.
Yes. But
then you could say historically Tucson buyers have been different to RAV4 buyers, but the Tucson is no longer priced what it used to be. So,
well, they are different because one's in a RAV4 and the other one's in a Tucson.
Thank you, James. See,
there's a massive difference, Mal.
Why did I see it before?
The last one that Steve calls out is the longest bow to draw, I'd argue, which is the Nexo. So a hydrogen fuel cell vehicle, which is in Australia in a very small pinky toe in the water kind of way, as Toyota has been with the Mirai. But that's a really interesting car. And I don't know about you guys. There's part of me that thinks that hydrogen fuel cell has a lot to offer, but it is a big call to expect all of the infrastructure that needs to go in to support hydrogen fuel cell will happen while electric is owning the territory in terms of putting the charging stations in.
Yeah, and it's a long way from owning the territory too. But
you were true.
Yeah, I love the fact that Nexo proves there's so much more to come and it's realistic.
Yeah.
You know, the car itself does a really good job.
Mm-hmm.
So surely that's the hard part out of the way.
Mm-hmm.
Just need more refueling stations. And, you know, that'll take a long time, but it's exciting to me to know that, you know, we're not all heading towards hoverboards.
Right. Well, I suppose the thing is, just at the risk of stating the bleeding obvious, that it brings together the zero tailpipe emissions benefit with the familiarity of being able to physically refuel the car and get going again in roughly the same time as it takes to fuel up an internal combustion car. I mean, that's got a lot of appeal.
Yeah, the real world practicality.
Yeah.
I think Nexo is almost like the headline vehicle of that hydrogen technology. But
yeah,
Hyundai are also working on a hydrogen powered truck. I think it's called Exeant, maybe.
Okay.
From memory.
Not called Optimus Prime.
confirmed. Optimus Prime is going to be a hydrogen truck in the future.
Sweet.
That's where that technology is really going to shine, isn't it? You know, you have big refueling stations for trucks that, you know, travel long distances that can be refueled in, you know, 20 minutes.
Yes.
Instead of having electric trucks that need to be charged overnight.
Yeah. I suppose there's also
Australia needs trucks to drive a long way. And
true.
Our rail network has scaled back, to my understanding. So we're going to need trucks in the future.
You know, Brisbane to Sydney, 1,000 kilometres. Sydney to Melbourne, 1,000 kilometres, typically done overnight. You need that kind of speed that kind of refueling ability, most definitely.
And to stop and refuel, you know, is such a waste of time and energy.
Sure. I mean, the heavy transport industry is already on such a cutthroat time schedule. Anything that would compromise that would be interesting, to say the least.
It's funny bringing up Nexo. I don't think Stephen Ottley mentioned this in his article, but like electrification is an area that Hyundai is well and truly ahead of Toyota on right now.
Any of the big players, or, you know, the ones worth feeding, are exploring multiple avenues all at the same time. So, you know, you look at Mercedes-Benz, they've had hydrogen fuel cell vehicles for a long time, Hyundai, Toyota, and they're not only down that road, they're down multiple roads, so hedging their bets, as it were. So, yeah, that does make sense.
Mm.
All right, well, that's good. I think good discussion. Thank you, guys. We'll We'll look forward to what our viewers and listeners think of all of that. But we'll move to the real world, such as it is, which is our garage and the cars that we have been driving this week. Mal, I'd like to kick off with you, please. And it's a Volkswagen. It's a Volkswagen capable of some pretty heavy lifting. Please fill us in.
Yeah, so I've finally managed to drive something I've always wanted to, but they're rarely available in the press fleet, so I haven't had the chance until now. And that's the Volkswagen Transporter dual cab cab chassis. Or,
okay,
yeah, lots of cab. It's which is the ute version of the van, basically.
But does that mean that it gets an extended wheelbase, or is the tray short? You know what I mean?
It's the tray is shorter than the single cab version, it's on the same Transporter LWB long
wheelbase. Okay, gotcha. Yep.
Chassis is the LWB van and the single cab chassis. have you guys driven any of the Transporter cab chassis?
No.
Not a cab chassis. No, I've driven the van, but not a cab chassis.
Okay. So for me, it's always struck me as a really smart way to do a dual cab ute, as long as you're not wanting hardcore off-road capability. Because of its, you know, it's effectively a cab over packaging, like a like a proper truck or a van, meaning that you've got all the room inside the cabin of a regular dual cab, but then the equivalent of a single cab, a normal single cab tray. So you've got the passengers and the cargo.
All right.
Within the same sort of footprint. But it's not quite the case, I'm afraid.
All right.
So I expected it to be quite civilized, but the reality is it's much more of a commercial truck than something like an Amarok. Or even the Hilux Ranger, you know, the usual ute fraternity.
Yeah.
In the way it drives, and also its lack of creature comforts. Even though it's a $60,000 car, $60,490 before on roads for the four motion version I drove.
Right. Does it have a radio?
Certainly has a radio. It has a radio, and it has CarPlay, Android Auto, and USB-C. Connections, which sort of like the latest and kind of annoying if you don't have.
I think that's a VW cable. Group thing, really, isn't it? They seem to be whole, Tiguan's, you know, across the board accepting USB-C.
Yeah, it surprised me the Tiguan's updated, you know.
Well, because the joke used to be how to insert a USB. Go one way, doesn't fit. Go upside down, doesn't fit. Go back to the first way, and that is the beauty of USB-C. There's no up and down. It's just, you know, you stick it in there, so it's good in that way.
Yeah, and I think...
Capable of charging and transferring data speeds a bit faster, Jason.
Yeah, is that as well, of course, yes.
I was going to say that too, Tung, but with words like bingo and better. But yeah.
Yeah, it's just better, right? It's just better.
But, man, when you're fumbling around for the, you know, the hole, it's so much easier and bound to be much easier on the cords, which, you know, we all know how annoying it is when you wear out a USB
cord. Kind of begs the question, why would a buyer buy, you know, the VW over a dual cab ute or something? No.
Yeah, good point. Well,
strap yourselves in. There's more to come.
Uh-huh.
So it's much more like a commercial truck in the way it drives. Now, the T6 generation has only been around a few years, and the T6.1 update only hit Australia this year.
That's right.
It feels quite old inside. Okay. It looks fantastic on the outside, but feels quite old inside. And in VW terms, it's more like a Mark 6 Golf than a Mark 8 Golf, which is imminent. There's no reversing camera for the cab chassis. The multimedia screen is only 6.5 inches, which is funny. We used to be really excited about 6-inch multimedia screens, but now it looks quite small. And as I said, it does have CarPlay and Android Auto, so that's great. Not everything does yet. The other surprises include that the front passenger seat isn't adjustable. So it's a bench seat. So the driver's seat is sort of, you know, recline and slide, but the passenger seats are fixed. You can't adjust the backrest. You can flop them forward to sort of have a flat surface,
right?
But you can't slide, recline, or you can't slide or recline it.
Okay.
And the back seat is very old school dual cab ute in that it's just a big flat cushion with a very upright backrest. And so it's a six-seater, but there's no child seat mounts in the back.
Oh, really? Is that even legal?
Yeah. There's lots of, you know, crew vans that that don't have, you know, the troop carrier was never child seat. Anyway, but ironically, it has child safety locks on the doors and the back doors.
Okay.
So your seven-plus-year-olds won't be able to escape.
Won't be able to escape, yep.
Like the Amarok, there's no backseat airbags, back doors. Interestingly, if you look at it close up, the back doors have external hinges, like, you know, a Mini.
Mini, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you'd immediately get those shaved, wouldn't you? You'd be down to the panel beaters and have it, you know, taken internal.
That sounds like a job. Anyway.
Is that, Mel, is it front-wheel drive?
So it's available in front-wheel drive or four-motion all-wheel drive. And the one I'm driving has the four-motion.
Four-motion. Okay. Okay, that's cool.
Four-motion adds $2,500,
$3,000. Wow. Okay.
So, you know, it's got the dirt road safety.
Or a work site, capability as well, I suppose.
I reversed it up some wet grass last night very confidently.
Fine. Very good. That's good to hear.
Good. It passed the wet grass reverse
test. Mel's wet grass reverse test. I think ANCAP is going to incorporate that into its assessment.
Well, they should.
Yeah.
Now, interestingly, so the back door trims, the front door trims, normal Volkswagen Transporter, but the back door trims, it's bit like a six, it's a bit like my H. Holden actually. It's all pressed steel and masonite, with a rudimentary door handle and door pull. On the passenger side, there's an ashtray in the door.
Oh, naughty, very naughty.
Is it European?
Oh, it's just tradies. They're on the darts regularly, mate.
Yeah,
that's okay. That's a very pragmatic, very sensible kind of addition,
but only on the left hand side. But the mechanicals do a really good job. It gets the most powerful of the three transporter trims for the 2-liter turbo diesel. So 146 kilowatts and 450 newton meters. I believe it's got two turbos, so it's be very closely related to the Amarok version of that engine.
Okay.
Really responsive for a diesel. Now, you would think that the truck-like driving experience would be a result of having a pretty significant payload, but it's only around a ton, which isn't huge.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no real payoff for the truck feel. There are some pluses though. It's got six seats. I can't think of any other conventional dual cabs with six seats. And the size of the tray means you can carry a lot of stuff, even if it's, you know, you can't carry a lot of heavy stuff.
All right.
But the bottom line is, I think if you look at it side on, it looks like a backwards baseball cap, and it's pretty cool. Pretty cool proportions.
Okay. Good. I think
Tung might agree with me there.
Yeah. Backwards baseball caps always cool.
Now, how much more, Mel? How much more?
Pushing the envelope.
I think you are, but.
Well, I'll wrap up then, James. Sorry to cut.
Please.
I must admit, I haven't had the chance to load it up and test it properly.
All right.
But you can read all about that in Osler's review on the site.
Very good.
And also Matt Campbell's extensive coverage of the entire range from the launch.
That's right. Exactly. Yes, he did do that. So thank you, Mel.
James. That's
good. Thank you. Thank you.
Who's next?
I appreciate that, Mel. The next person to step forward is Tung. And Tung, we've been talking a lot about Hyundai. Let's be a bit more specific. What have you been driving?
I picked up a Kona N-Line a few days ago, which Matthew Pritchard is probably flashing up on the screen right now.
Uh-huh.
So I've only picked it up for a couple of days. I haven't really had a chance to drive it because Melbourne is in another lockdown again.
I guess
my initial thoughts, it looks really good. The facelifted Kona, I think it just makes the styling, exterior styling of the car previously, I thought it was a bit just quirky for the sake of being quirky. Now, to me, it looks a lot more cohesive and a lot more confident.
Great.
And I'm really glad they haven't toned it down. Like, they've owned its quirk.
Totally.
But embraced it rather than softening it.
especially in N-line trim, they add a few sort of sporting elements and things like that. But the biggest change is that the, you know, the black plastic cladding around the wheel arches, it's now body colored.
Okay.
And I, it makes it look a little bit more like a hatchback than an SUV.
Right.
I think it works really, really well for that car.
Because it's pretty close to it.
Yeah.
And where's the Tung, on that theme, where do you think it sits in terms of your point from earlier that Hyundai may be going into risky territory in trying to, spice up their game in terms of the way the cars look?
I think, like, there's no doubt that the Kona is aimed at a younger audience.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not saying that I am young, but I am a fan of the car, the way that car looks.
So I'm saying you're young.
Yeah, yeah. Speak for yourself, you young fellas.
It's all relative, guys.
Thanks, James. You're young too, by the way.
The Kona, you know, talks to that kind of like first car buyer, 20 to 30 year old, like no kids, you know, maybe a dog in the back sort of buyer. And it does it really well because the tech's there. You know, the interior, the plastics in the interior are a little bit hard and scratchy, but, you know, you have things like a wireless smartphone charger. There's a 10.25-inch digital instrument cluster in the Kona N line. It's got sport seats, those like leather accent, red.
Man, nice.
Stitching accents and things like that as well. So
is yours the 2-liter or the 1.6?
It's the 2-liter.
Sorry if you've already said that.
No, so sorry, 1.6-liter. 1.6-liter.
1.6, yep. Okay. So I think it's a bit of a shame that you can get the inline package in both with both engines.
Mm. Right. You should reserve it for something that's a little more special, you think?
Well, the performance leader,
is only available. Oh, no, it is available in both. Sorry. Yep, never mind.
Yeah. So it's a bit like how you can get an A-Class, an A180 with the AMG pack that is pretty close to, you know, what's fitted to the A35.
Yeah.
You know, aside from, I think, exhaust outlets. And look, that works really well for Mercedes. Mm. They sell lots of AMG kits and, you know, clearly Hyundai's aiming to do the same thing. But given N is in its infancy,
mm-hmm.
I prefer to sort of see it mean something.
Mm. All right.
You can read Matt Campbell's extensive coverage. Or was it Chester? Anyway, we have extensive coverage.
Chester did the launch for that car. Extensive review and a video review up on the Cars Guide website.
Beautiful.
I always get those
beautiful.
Two guys confused.
Yes, sorry, well, guys. They're both fantastic human beings. How could you not mix them up? The what I'll go to as the closer on the garage is Lexus IS 350 and the F Sport. So that's a 3.5-liter Atmo V6, 232 kilowatts, 380 newton meters. Unlike the turbos that we're so used to, that torque's peak is 4,800 RPM, so it's quite high in the rev range. 8-speed auto, rear-wheel drive, $75,000. So it's in there with the light, you know, generally speaking, like an S4 Audi, maybe, although it's more expensive. A 330i BMW with the M Sport kit, that's about 80K. So it's in there. A Merc AMG CLA 35 is a little dearer, but similar. Jag XE with the R Dynamic HSC P300, blah, blah, blah. On it goes. So it's in that kind of Euro thing. It's the Japanese contender amongst those Euro offerings. The one that we had, it's just, this is how superficial I am. It's such a great color. It's in a color called infrared. But even just in photographing it for the pics that people on YouTube will be having a look at now, it really sings in the sun. It looks fantastic, sets the car off beautifully. The other thing I noticed with the seats are really nicely designed and they feel fantastic, both from a kind of locating you point of view, but also a comfort point of view. The electric steering is really good, and that's not something I'm used to always with a Lexus. And I love the steering wheel itself too, the size of it, the feel of it. Really enjoyed that. Quality ride. It rides beautifully. And there's a surprising amount of rear space. It's not a huge car. And when you're in the back, there's behind my driving position, I had a fair bit of leg room and headroom, more than I expected. And it's kind of rare to drive a naturally aspirated car these days. And to hear the engine, it's all genuine engine noise and it sounds really nice. I enjoyed that particularly. The only real negatives I could come up with were it's a very dark interior. Mm. I quite like it, but I can imagine that others may not. And the exterior design, it's a Lexus thing across the board, really. It's likely to polarize because it is very angular and it has that now recognizably Lexus look. But I think over generations, the IS is getting sleeker and sleeker. And it's maybe still not to my taste for what it's worth, but it is changing over time. I enjoy driving the car a little more than I expected to, frankly. So I thought it was pretty good.
I think the proportions have made a really big improvement with this most recent version, in that the rear end's kind of pumped. It looks more substantial.
The wheels had that kind of, what is it, like a satin, black, chromey, charcoal-y kind of look to them. And often I think that can look a bit too Hollywood Boulevard and dressed up. But on this car, with that very warm colour, it was a beautiful combination. I thought it looked great.
What a shame that we don't get the V8 version of that car.
Boy.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think we'll go to an RC for a... for a proper, if it's still on sale, I'm not even sure. I think it's still offered, but I'm not 100% sure.
RCF, yeah. Can you imagine like a V8 IS?
Yeah. Well, that used to be ISF.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, now, so that's our garage. And look, as I mentioned at the top of the show, we've put our heads together, which typically generates at least 2 to 3 candle power. And looked at ways of improving the podcast. And one was to lift our engagement with listeners and viewers. And to that end, we intend to focus on responding to your feedback and continuing the conversation directly. So that is, we want to talk to you via the YouTube comments section and respond to your thoughts posted to comments@carsguide.com.au as soon as possible. So as always, we look forward to chatting with anyone about anything we've said or done to put more flesh on this podcast bones, but we'll do it directly in the comments on YouTube or via responses to your emails. So really at this point, that is the finish line. We have reached it. And I want to say thank you, Tom.
Transform and roll out, everyone.
And thank you. And thank you, Mal.
Thank you, James and Tom. It's been a pleasure.
Good. And thanks to our computational wizard, freelance genius, and champion of love and light, Mr. Pritchard, for his skill and dedication to the Cars Guide podcast cause. Today, he's wearing a T-shirt saying, "Just Deforced, party time, fire tiger pants, and banana shoes." And they have the skins peeled back, which is mildly confronting. Let us know your thoughts. You can find Cars Guide on Facebook and Instagram. And as I said just a minute ago, email us at comments@carsguide.com.au. Also, as I mentioned earlier, we'll be ready to respond in the YouTube comments section. And if you're an Apple podcast listener, please rate and review us. And on that note, thanks to AAAA Play, who I think owns AAA Aardvark Electrical, and Chris_Adel, who recently did just that. And we've cracked 100 ratings. Thank you. And somehow we're still at 5 stars. So that is terrific news. Make sure you subscribe to the Cars Guide YouTube channel so you can stay on top of all our latest content, or, of course, visit the site. But before we go, look, I keep being harassed by the same bike at the same place every day on my way to work. It's been going on for weeks. In fact, I think it's a vicious cycle.